This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday and happy snow day, everyone. To keep you company on a slow, yeah, slushy commute, we offer you the Week in Review, beginning with a saga out of Suffolk University. President Margaret McKenna under fire from the University Board of Trustees and a very public fight in the pages of the Globe and the Herald over the leadership of Suffolk's fifth president in 5 years. Suffolk's faculty and students, however, are reeling from the uncertainty.
It makes students worry what that does to the value of their degree. You know, Suffolk is a pretty big institution. We have a pretty good name for ourselves, but all this turnover and the way that the board handled this in the press really brings some concern to students.
Keep McKenna! Keep McKenna! Keep McKenna!
I think we need stability, and I think we need stability sort of with an academic vision, educational vision. And we thought, that's why this is so upsetting. We thought we had that, and suddenly it's under threat.
Well, Board of Trustees Chairman Andrew Meyer and President Margaret McKenna say they've reached some kind of proposal that they're presenting to the full board today. Also this week, a public records access bill clears the Massachusetts Senate, and of course, there's the run-up to the New Hampshire primary. So here to talk about it all with us is Richard Tessay, former Republican minority leader of the Massachusetts State Senate. Richard, great to have you back.
Happy to be here.
Also today, investigative reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe, the one and only Shira Springer. Shira, great to have you back as
Thanks for having me here again.
So Richard and Shira, let's just start right in there with Suffolk University and the row between the board and Margaret McKenna. Richard, let's start with you. Do you think McKenna's going to stay on as Suffolk? And what do you make of the fact of this battle that's been happening over the past week?
At this point, it's obvious she's going to stay on. And it's been kind of like watching a car wreck. You know, everybody sort of slows down and looks at it. It's very, very interesting because you have so many different power players involved here in Boston. And, you know, just as somebody who's been watching the whole thing, you know, clearly the board did not handle things right. I mean, the Board of Trustees aren't doing a very good job with the institution if you have five presidents in 5 years. And I think for Suffolk, it is a great institution, and it's been hurt, obviously, by what's transpired. If you get the Boston Globe and look in the Capital section today, there's a big half-page ad, which obviously has been pre-planned for a while. Public problems, Suffolk solutions. And you could kind of reverse the words and come up with something else. But I think it has hurt the school, and the sooner they can resolve it and put it in the rearview mirror, the better.
Yeah, so the Globe is reporting that, yes, they're presenting some kind of proposal to the board today, as we said. Mark Arsenal reporting that his sources say in the deal, McKenna would keep her job. Over in the pages of the Herald, Joe Battenfeld says that his sources say that not only will McKenna save her job, but the fact that Andrew Meyer may no longer be chairman of the board, although his chairmanship was supposed to end this spring anyway. And perhaps Suffolk's longtime PR guy, George Regan, his contract may be in jeopardy. That's according to sources speaking to the Boston Herald and Joe Battenfeld over there. So, Shira Springer, what do you make of all this?
Well, I think really McKenna had to stay at this point. This is an institution that's had five presidents in the last 5 years, and you can't just keep having a revolving door of presidents. And I do think that Andrew Meyer is probably on his way out, because I think when you it's hard to work with somebody, who's the chair of the board, who tried to oust you. And that's what went on. I don't think there could be a really successful and cooperative agreement. And I just think what was really interesting about this whole situation was the support, the overwhelming support that McKenna got from the student body, from alumni, from Mayor Walsh, from local business leaders. They all wanted her to stay and saw that she had a vision for the university, and also saw that the board was overstepping its bounds.
Yeah. So we should also note that Attorney General Maura Healey said that she may take a look into the fact that accrediting institutions say that they want to look at the Suffolk board's behavior and whether or not it's basically too intrusive in terms of the university's activities. Shira?
Yeah, they were supposed to do some bylaw reforms and some other reforms, and they either didn't quite get to them in a timely fashion. So she wants to look into how the board operates and how it intersects with the administration.
Well, I said a minute ago, everybody is involved in this one way or another, and the Attorney General certainly found a way to insert herself into the story very late. And I'd also mention, it's worth noting, the Globe's covered this pretty heavily. And one of the issues that the board had with the president was that she was making a lot of expenditures. There was a A lease that she signed. You know, they don't have a lot of money in reserve or a big endowment at that school, and they've been using some of the endowment money just for operation expenses. But it's funny because the Boston Globe, one of the issues was that she signed a marketing agreement for $670,000 with the Boston Globe without going to the board, hence the half-page ad in the Globe today. Without getting permission. So, I mean, it's funny. The Globe's involved, the Attorney General, just about everybody, George Regan, everybody's involved one way or the other.
Yeah, you know, there's so many questions here that I have, you know, for folks other than you. I mean, I'm curious about just, you know, how much permission does the president need from the board for things like that? Maybe that was the terms of her contract. I'm not sure.
I'm interested that the Globe didn't disclose that when they editorialized.
Let's be honest, this is 7 months. She's only been there 7 months. I feel like they should give her a chance to see how she can make good on her vision. I mean, that's an awful short time to be evaluating and criticizing her. I think another one of the criticisms of her was she has an aggressive manner. And some of the students were saying in response to that, well, maybe it's about time somebody told the board, you know, they can't be all powerful and be as intrusive as they were in the daily operations of the university.
And it's interesting to note Martha Coakley's role in this. Right. Again, everybody's involved.
But she wisely backed out.
Clearly, things were being wired for her. And
yes, her name was being floated as replacing McKenna.
Yeah, and she wisely backed out of the whole controversy.
Last question about this before we move on. I have to say, one of the interesting sub-stories here for me is that this whole battle was so public in the pages of the Herald and the Globe. Now, on the one hand, maybe it's good reporting, but on the other hand, unnamed sources were speaking to both of these newspapers as if they were just launching one horrible trial balloon after another, trying to get a feel as to what the reaction might be. I mean, this doesn't seem to be the way to actually have an important discussion about leadership at a university.
Communicate between your president and the chair of your board. I mean, you do not air your grievances out in the public. You meet, you talk about it like civilized adults, and that wasn't happening here.
Again, Suffolk has a great reputation, so hopefully we can put this behind them and move on. Forget it all happened as soon as possible.
The students deserve better.
Yeah.
We are in recruiting time.
Spring is upon us any moment now, weather aside, right? Okay, so that's the story out of Suffolk. And of course, if any news emerges from the board meeting today while we're on the air, we'll keep you up to date. But let's move on very briefly, if we can, to Massachusetts. Sorry state of public records laws, because maybe we're seeing some change on that. The Massachusetts State Senate passed its version of reform to the public records law just yesterday. Their bill would cut down on long wait times for public records requests and make it easier for folks looking for information to recoup legal fees for processing those requests. So here's Senate President Stan Rosenberg talking about the bill just after its passage.
It's about giving people access to the information to which they're entitled, and we need to work together, state and local government, with the citizenry to make sure that they have timely access at a reasonable cost.
Okay, so Richard, the charitable part of me says, finally, good job, legislature. You're taking steps forward on the dismal public records laws in Massachusetts. But on the other hand, this bill doesn't even address the fact that the governor's office, the legislature, or the judiciary are not subject to public records requests.
Exempted.
So what difference does it make?
And, you know, just to complete the irony, now that the House has passed, the Senate's passed a bill, the House has already passed one, there will be a secret conference committee set up to come up with the final version of the bill.
Yeah,
so much for transparency. But you know what? This is good because there are a lot of individuals and organizations that try to get public records. There's no penalty really in Massachusetts when the government says no. They can charge you a lot of money. They can just make outrageous delays. And, you know, we're the worst state in the entire country when it comes to being able to access this information. So one step forward. But again, you point out the flaws.
Yeah, I'm up the one step forward.
Common Cause likes the Senate bill, but to me, that's akin to having had clouds overhead for 100 years and one ray of sunshine shining through. You're like, I love the one ray of sunshine, but there's still clouds.
Yeah, there's still clouds, but you got to be optimistic at this point that the legislature recognizes they have a problem here. And let's credit my colleague at the Boston Globe, Todd Wallach, for some just extraordinary reporting throughout all of this in terms of how difficult it was or is to get public records And when you talk about exorbitant costs, I think there was one article that Todd wrote where there was an attorney from Taunton who was doing looking for the accuracy of breathalyzer tests and had asked the Massachusetts State Police for some data.
That's right.
And they had charged him, or were going to charge him, something like $2.7 million for access to that information, when every other state he had asked for that information from, there was either no fee, or I think Wisconsin had something like a $75 fee for that information. So, listen, I think the progress is going to be slow. It'll be interesting to see how the House and Senate come together if we are actually privy to what happens in that secret conference. But it's high time that this some reform, or the wheels of reform, started turning on this.
Okay, so let's hope that the wheels keep turning after this one step forward. So that's the...
Well, I know some reporters who will be on it.
Public records story for the week. But let's move on to really the big story, political story, and that, of course, is up north, and that's the coming New Hampshire primary. And in order to have an intelligent, cogent conversation about this, I'm going to bring in another one to help me out here. Anthony Brooks joining us, WBUR senior political reporter. He's been in New Hampshire putting, what, thousands of miles on your car?
Thousands and thousands. From one end of the state to the other. And that's at least 1,000 miles. Anyway, it's good to be here. Nice to see you
Great
all.
To have you. So WBUR has just released a new poll on New Hampshire in the last hour. Can you just give us the quick headline on
yeah,
that?
Yeah, sure. So here are the two top lines. Shows a slight tightening of the race between the Democrats, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Sanders leading 54-39. What's interesting about that number is he's pretty much where he's always been. Hillary Clinton has come up a little bit. And this probably makes sense. There's a lot of excitement. Lots of people are paying attention to the race. So it makes sense that it's tightening a little bit, but Sanders still holds a lead there. On the Republican side, Trump still on top, 29%. That's pretty much where he's been since the early fall. Our poll shows Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz at 12%, Jeb Bush and John Kasich at 10%. What's interesting about this poll, the BUR poll, is it's a bit of an outlier because a bunch of other polls, including the Boston Globe, show that Rubio has really gotten a bit of a bounce since Iowa and is actually moving up on Trump. The Globe has him just 10 points behind Trump, so we'll see how that goes.
Okay, so I'm going to talk to you more in a second, Anthony, but let me just get a quick take from Shira and Richard. Anything in those numbers that surprise you?
I would tend to just from what I know and who I talk to and see, say that Rubio is surging right now.
That's the sense I get just anecdotally. I mean, even at Trump rallies, I talked to people who were for Trump, but they said, but I'm going to see Marco Rubio. They were very excited about what he did in Iowa, and they were thinking, you know, maybe they'd swing in his direction. And I heard that again and again and again. So you get the sense of a Rubio surge on the ground.
And I would say nothing surprises me at this point with anything. I mean, you've got, you know, please clap Jeb Bush. I mean, you've got Ernie Bach Jr. and his likening his support to Trump to picking up a woman at a bar at 2 a.m. Yeah. I mean, come on. Yeah. Numbers, the least surprising aspect of this race.
On the Democratic side, it doesn't surprise me that much either she's, you know, the margin isn't going to be that big. And I think at the end of the night, Hillary's going to declare herself the comeback kid, just like her husband did.
Yeah.
You know,
it really is a game of expectations for her. I'd also say that, you know, I was talking to Andy Smith up at the UNH Polling Center yesterday. 40% of Republicans are still undecided as of yesterday. That's a huge number. So there's a lot that can happen. And what we learned also in Iowa is that these polls don't necessarily reflect what's going to happen on Election Day. Donald Trump has said he learned his lesson about the ground game, and where is he today? He snowed out of New Hampshire, and Richard Desai can probably speak to this as well as anyone as a successful politician. You can't decide on Friday that you're going to get your ground game sort of back on track next Friday. You know, it doesn't work like
that. And he was in Arkansas after Iowa. I mean, it just doesn't seem like he either cares or wants to make the effort or particularly likes to spend time in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
I think, you know, what's going to be interesting, the difference between Iowa and New Hampshire is that in New Hampshire, if you're an independent, you can vote in either party's primary. And there's going to be a big group of independents that are some of them straddle both parties. So they're either going to vote in the Democratic or the Republican. And it's going to be interesting to see where they go, because if they go into the Republican primary, they could certainly help John Kasich or a more moderate candidate, or maybe Aaron Rubio. If it's a Democratic primary, are they going to go with Hillary or are they going to go with Sanders? And in independents overwhelmingly in Iowa went with Sanders. Mm-hmm. So it could really end up.
Yeah, and we did a poll. Our previous poll showed that the independents were the Democratic leaning independents were favoring Sanders in New Hampshire. So Hillary's hope is that a lot of those independents pull a Republican ballot right. because most of them would otherwise be voting for Sanders.
For Sanders.
And if they feel as though that you know Sanders has it, it's going to be a 20-point margin, they might want to go into the Republican primary.
Although I'm seeing a subhead here in the WBUR poll that's found that 82% of independents say they, quote, want to vote for a candidate who aligns with me on the issues.
I think that would be Sanders.
That almost sounds like an Onion headline, actually.
But you know what you see happening, though? On the Democratic side, it's a fight on who's the most progressive, and
right.
they've gone way left. On the Republican side, they've gone way right. And there are all these people in the middle who don't feel like, you know, that's why a Bloomberg is, you know, could be a very appealing candidate for a lot of people that aren't radical on one side or the other, but they want somebody sort of in the middle.
Well, on that note, Anthony, you were actually at the Democratic debate last night, right?
Yeah, interesting debate. I actually thought this is going to sound wishy-washy because I'm going to come in right down the middle like I'm supposed to. I thought they both did really, really well when they were talking on their turf. I mean, I thought it was interesting that the first 30 or 40 minutes of the debate was definitely Sanders' turf. It was about the economy, about jobs, about economic disparity. And I actually thought, I don't want to say dominated, but I thought he got the better of Clinton in that part of the debate. But when the debate turned toward foreign policy,
she really showed her command.
Showed her command of stuff. And you know, in the spin room, a lot of Sanders, I saw Tad Devine, one of Bernie Sanders' top advisors, and reporters were saying, did you guys not prep him on the foreign policy stuff? I mean, what gives? Because he did seem a little bit out of his depth in that. And, you know, I think why that bodes well for Sanders is because there seems to be a real consciousness and sensitivity in this time to these economic issues, and that's what he's talking about. But if you're worried about experience and the state of world affairs, you've got to stop and give Hillary Clinton credit.
I just look at it, if you're Hillary Clinton right now and you're fighting with Bernie Sanders about who the most progressive candidate is, it's a fight that she's not going to win.
Right.
And it's not a good sign for where her campaign is right now.
Sure. Did you want to jump in here?
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right, Richard. And that was what I was going to say. I mean, I don't think she's going to always be outflanked on the left by Bernie. And, you know, I think we keep coming back to this over and over again with Hillary. But the real problem that I saw in the debate that comes across to me is just, you know, Bernie also has her on the authenticity and trustworthiness factor. It's I don't want to say she's unlikable, but you don't feel it's hard to embrace her as a candidate. And you could even see just, you know, at the end of the debate where, you know, the crowds were cheering and they were sort of waving to the crowds. The roar was for Bernie. And, you know, there was just sort of a tepid reaction to Hillary waving to the audience. And I don't know how you overcome that likability factor, but she is not a strong campaigner. She is not connecting.
I will
say
this, though. When her back is up against the wall, and you really do feel these are final days in New Hampshire, her campaign events right now in New Hampshire, they're very well attended. There are a lot of really, really loyal folks in New Hampshire. I mean, it's basically the dyed-in-the-wool Democrats that have been loyal to Bill Clinton for a long, long time, and mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton. She's been involved with a lot of campaigns up there. And you feel, actually, in this period, real enthusiasm for her.
That's a great point. And what's also interesting, though, is a lot of time has gone by you know, from when Bill Clinton was president.
Yeah.
So a lot of people, younger people, have never experienced the Clinton magic. 70% of people under 29 years old voted Democrats, voted for Sanders. And the numbers in New Hampshire look pretty similar. And she obviously is having trouble connecting with the younger generation.
And with younger women, which is also deeply concerning.
And could end up being, that could be the group at the end of the day, if she's the nominee and you get a Rubio, a young generational type leader, that could end up being the group that decides the election.
You know, on the other hand, I actually thought that that highlighted one of Bernie Sanders' actually weaker moments in the debate when he was asked about, like, what would his general election strategy be and how could he carry over the enthusiasm from his far-left progressive base right now into a general election. He said, well, you know, we're energizing young people, we're energizing, you know, others, this, that, and the other. And it didn't seem to be a strategy, but rather a hope that he could carry his momentum into a general election and get all those, you know, apathetic college vote kids to actually get to the polls, which I'm not, you know, that doesn't seem like a strategy.
No, it doesn't. Because the good thing for Hillary is that the group of voters that are around her and supporting her are the most reliable group of voters. They tend to be older. They tend to be also older women. So those are the people you know who are going to show up. I would not want to base my campaign on a bunch of college kids and pray that they're going to show up and vote for you.
And those reliable voters become super reliable once you get out in New Hampshire, you know, as far as minorities go in the South and other places. And she's going to be the nominee, but she's going to end up being a very weak nominee. And
so, I don't know if she's going to be a weak. See, I disagree with that. I think that this is actually good for Hillary Clinton. I think being challenged and having to really think about how she presents herself and how she presents her message.
See, I agree
good.
With that, Shira, but I also agree with Richard, because the problem that Hillary Clinton is facing right now is playing to the left of Bernie Sanders to win this primary and these early primaries puts her in an awkward situation down the road when she needs to make a case that I am in the middle and I can win this general election and I'm a pragmatist who can get things done. She's going to have a lot of people sort of coming after her saying, yeah, a couple of months ago, you were talking about what a lefty progressive wacko you were. And
she's
that's not going to work.
She's out of sync with the base of her party, like Bush is with the out of sync with the base of his party.
At least she doesn't have to ask for applause.
Well, yeah, it isn't quite as bad for her, but it's a similar situation.
And she's not
situation.
Carrying around turtles in her pocket and presenting them to little kids as a metaphor for the slow but steady wins the race.
But if an Elizabeth Warren had run, I think you'd be looking at like a totally different race. She would have been, would have had the look at.
Well, that's going to be an interesting thing down the road to see who Warren endorses.
Well, we have just enough time to do like very short hubbubs before we wrap up today. And Anthony, I'd love to start with you.
So I've got to do a hubbub from the campaign. So it comes from Monday night, the Iowa caucus. And this, of course, is the Ben Carson thing when instead of racing off to New Hampshire like the other candidates, he headed home to Florida. And it led to speculation that he was dropping out. And then we've heard this, right? His campaign put out a statement. After spending 18 consecutive days on the campaign, Dr. Carson needs to go home and get a fresh set of clothes. Okay, but this has led to all
kinds
of interest.
Going to introduce him to the laundromat.
So just listen to these tweets. Eric Fernstrom, former Mitt Romney campaign official. We used to rely on laundromats and dry cleaners. Times change, I guess. Here's one more from Amanda Turkle, politics editor, Huffington Post. I find it so annoying to go to my apartment building's basement to do laundry. I certainly wouldn't fly to Florida to do it. And here's my favorite from West Wing reports. Huckabee out. O'Malley out. Trump loses. Carson doing laundry, and it's only 10:30. Anyway, I love that story.
Apparently, they have stores in Iowa, right? Like, if you really needed new
and
clothes.
Laundry detergent, supposedly.
So, running out of time, you told me to talk really fast.
Okay.
According to Boston.com, there's more to our speech pattern here in Massachusetts than just our accent. In fact, we are the third fastest talking state in the nation, according to a study done by the analytics company Marchex. The company's institute studied more than 4 million phone calls placed from consumers to businesses from 2013 to 2015 using technology that automatically monitors speech, silence, ringtones, and hold times to uncover speech patterns in all the different 50 states. The only states that ranked higher than Massachusetts in terms of fastness were Oregon and Minnesota.
That makes no sense to me. I grew up in Oregon. I don't understand. Where are all these fast talkers in Oregon?
The slowest were Mississippi, Louisiana, and South Carolina. The study also found that Massachusetts was number 14th as far as the most talkative state, which determined by the number of words used in the conversations, and the 28th least patient state, putting us right smack dab in the middle of the list of states most likely to hang up when you're put on hold.
Wow.
How's that? That's from Boston.com.
So true. Like 15 seconds have gone by, and I've crammed in 2,000 words, hang up.
I'm going to talk about a different kind of race and a different kind of speed here. First of all, the U.S. Olympic Marathon trials are taking place next Saturday in Los Angeles. And this week, race officials are finalizing the men's and women's fields. And at last count, Massachusetts will be represented by 24 runners, 15 women and 9 men. That's an incredibly impressive number, considering that most of the runners who will be representing Massachusetts are not professional runners, and they have to train through our winters. So if you see a runner speeding through the slush and snow today, there's a chance you might be looking at a future Olympian.
Wow. Well, at the least, they get a medal for perseverance for running in the snow. Okay, so my hubbub is a very, very quick one, because we've talked a lot about all the different reasons why there's a high cost of living, and it's super expensive to live in Boston. Here's another one, because Boston apparently has ranked as one of the worst cities to get married in. This is by Wallet Hub, a personal finance company. We rank 141st out of 150s because of 18 key indicators of nuptial friendliness, ranging from average wedding costs to numbers of venues and event spaces per capita to availability of hotels.
And we talk fast. I'm sure that plays into it somehow.
So at least maybe the ceremony is at least short, right? Well, Anthony Brooks, WBUR senior political reporter, great to have you in the studio. You got to get back on the road and get up north.
Got to fight my way through the snow.
Thanks so much, Anthony.
Pleasure to be here. Have a great weekend.
And Richard Tesei, former Massachusetts state senator. He served as minority leader of the Massachusetts Senate as well. Thanks so much, Richard.
Thanks for being here.
Shira Springer, investigative reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe. Thank you as always.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.